this time we are joined by the ever so wonderful, Ooh, God, I've gone really southern then. Let's try that one again. Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the next stage. Listen, we had a brief interlude last week, but we're back. And we have got a bumper episode for you. This time, we are joined by Simone Spiteri, arguably the Empress of Maltese Theatre, who is a writer, she's a director, she's a producer, she's an actor, you name it, she's probably done it. We're gonna delve straight into it. Enjoy, everyone.
Hello everyone, we are joined by the ever so lovely Simone Spiteri, the lady that wears millions of hats, and I have no clue how she manages to keep up with everything she does. Say hi, Simone.
Hi, hello.
Are you ready to get started?
Yes, let's do this.
All right, so the first question is, what is your first theatre-related memory?
Well, I grew up in the 80s. In the south of Malta, the southest you can get, in Birzabuja. And I do actually remember childhoods where playing for a whole day out in the streets was a normal thing, which is what we did, especially in summer. It's also a beach town, so kind of that was my life, you know, beach and playing in the streets. And I lived in an area where there were lots of kids in the neighborhood, so on a typical summer night, it would have been very easy to have like 50 odd kids playing in different groups in the road. Very few cars would drive by, so it was very safe. Our parents would be sitting in the front gardens chatting, so you know, we would be kind of within reach. And I think my earliest memory is like writing these little tiny plays and putting them up in my parents' front garden and asking the neighborhood kids to sort of come and watch, you know, I mean, play, the word play is very, being very generous here, obviously, because I was like 5 or 6, maybe. it's really funny, because actually, recently, I was going through some like old boxes, and I actually found a hand drawn program we did for this show, because we didn't even know how to call it. We just called it a show, sort of. So I think that's my earliest memory. And obviously, you know, I would boss my neighbors and my siblings to, it wasn't an option for them. They had to be in it, sort of, you know. So those are my earliest memories.
How sweet. You've been writing ever since you were 5.
Yes, I guess. But, till I was a young adult, actually, it wasn't really something that you aspired to do, not just the writing part, just anything, like being, like giving yourself the title of, you know, I mean, like I grew up with my friends saying I want to be a doctor and I want to be a whatever, you know, fill in the blanks. But just saying I want to be an actor, I want to be a writer, you didn't even say it, because it was like not, we didn't know anyone who did it. I have no one in my family is related to the arts at all. We didn't go to the theater. There was no theater to go to, especially for kids. So it just was not a thing. It was something, it was playing. It was just play, you know. And I think I stayed in that mind frame, especially with the writing, until I was probably in my 20s, I think. I mean, the acting came a little bit earlier than that, through like a series of very lucky events. But I was not, I mean, when you look at, you know, sort of my background, there wasn't absolutely nothing written in the stars for me to naturally fall in this world. You know, it's quite a random thing, you know, because there was absolutely nothing that could have, you know, it's not like I come from a family of artists or nothing, absolutely nothing.
Let's go a little bit into you, Simone, as a person, and how you kind of operate in the industry, shall we say. As Chris has mentioned, you are someone who apparently wears lots of hats. I assume not physically, but in a metaphorical sense.
No, actually, finding hats that fit me is always a huge problem.
Oh no.
I love them, but I have a wide head and very thick hair, so
Yeah, is it like a
no hat ever fits me,
is it
so
like a stretch
quite
beanie in a
ironic.
bubble situation?
Yes, it's quite ironic.
Yeah. So, kind of give us, give a listener who is like, okay, I don't know who you are. Give us a little
Okay.
bit of an indication what you do, what's the sort of avenues you dabble in, and is there a
Yeah.
specific one of them that you prefer more than another or have a bit more of like a sentimental value towards, should we say?
Well, if I had to go, in reverse, for the last 3 years now, sort of being a full-time artist has been my job, sort of, and the majority of that time is taken up by writing, not exclusively, because I occasionally act and direct sometimes, but writing is sort of what takes up the biggest chunk of time, and writing for different types of media. So the bulk is theater, but I do a lot of screenwriting, creative writing overall, but I think the biggest bulk is probably in theater and screen. Prior to that, however, I was a teacher for 15 years. I taught various ages, but mainly teenage boys for 15 years between the ages of like 11 and 16, which I don't do anymore. The little teaching left in my life now is I'm a visiting lecturer at the University of Malta in the School of Performing Arts department. And I'm the director of learning of Studio 18, but I don't teach much there. I just have a playwriting program. But that's what I did for 15 years while also cultivating all the work I've done in the theater. So, I mean, looking back, I have no idea how I managed to do it, because a full-time job, especially teaching, is very, very, very exhausting. But I could only make this shift in the last 3 years because I had slowly built my work over that span of time. And then eventually there came a point where I said, I think I am in a position where I can try and do it full time. I took this decision a couple of months before COVID hit, so I wasn't sure at the beginning if it was going to be possible to maintain, but thankfully I have, and I never went back to teaching, and now I don't imagine myself doing anything else. I mean, sentimentally, I don't know. I don't think it's a sentimental choice, what I'm going to say. But I think out of all the things I do now, writing is probably the most important and the one I feel the most responsible about. Because I think that's where my voice is. I think that's where I can, write about the things that I think we should be speaking about, especially in the arts, and maybe we're not doing enough of, even though there's so much going on around us, like in the country, in the world. It does not mean it's the most enjoyable, but I would much rather. I much rather obviously enjoy when I'm just one of the actors in the cast and I'm having a ball. I just had this experience with Castillo a couple of weeks ago. I mean, it was a luxury. Yeah, I just turn up with my script and I'm not worrying about anything else except my part, and that's it. Which happens very, very rarely because I'm either the playwright or if it's a production of my company, then I'm also the producer. So you're kind of thinking about a million things, and it's fun still, but not in the same way. But writing now has become a little bit. I approach it with a lot of responsibility. It's always an excruciating process for me, because I write about very difficult things, especially political theater. I mean, things that are very sensitive and things which are very heavy sometimes. So it's not, I really do not subscribe to this romantic idea of the playwright sitting in the middle of the night and then loving the sound of the keyboard. I do not like. I don't do that, and I feel like, I mean, Greta's gonna laugh because I've mentioned this before, but I feel like I'm in The Exorcist when I'm writing, you know? It's like I just need it to get out of me because it's no fun. But it's important, so I keep doing it.
That's a fabulous reference. Just like, just mixing up, contorting your body.
Yeah. It is. I mean, I don't know about other writers, obviously. I can't speak for them, but to me, it's not enjoyable in the sense of...
It's not enjoyable in the way I enjoy turning up for a rehearsal and exploring a character and having fun with your teammates and with a scene partner. I mean, the writing bit, not the rehearsing bit, because once my script is finished and then it starts being worked upon and sometimes I would be directing it, then that, yes, I find that to be extremely fun and creative. But the writing, until it just gets on page for a first draft, I mean, it's painful.
I can completely sympathise with you on that one. Like, it's a bit like when you are, I mean, let's say in your position, like when you're writing, directing, even producing, would you say?
Yeah.
You, it's not a thing that you kind of just put down at the end and see it later.
No.
It's like you have a innate responsibility for it. Like, not only are you making sure the cogs are turning, you're making sure there are cogs to turn in the first place. Yeah. It's that sort of cycle. So I can understand what you're getting at.
Well, Sim, you've mentioned writing and you being an exorcist while writing. And you've done work in both Maltese and English. Do you have like a preferred language to use?
I get this question a lot. And to be honest, I don't really like... I don't think it's a question of preference. I don't think I can ever choose, for the very simple reason that, for me, writing in English is a skill. I can use the language in a way that I can get what I want to say across. But writing in Maltese, it's my visceral language. It's not even my mother language, because I think we have to make a bit of a distinction between mother language and visceral language. Because there are a lot of people here on the island who are born and bred here, and English is their preferred language to communicate in, which, you know, there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. But then I feel that there is something visceral about the impact the Maltese language has on us, irrespective of what your chosen language to communicate with is. And to me, Maltese is not just my mother language, it's the language which goes a couple layers further, you know, in terms of depth. And I can, no matter how amazingly I can write in English, I'm not saying I'm an amazing writer in English, but even if I had to write the perfect play in English, it will never have the same nuance that my play in Maltese will have, because it's just my... I can't explain it in any other way. It's something which is visceral for me. It's not just because I can use the language. It's something else, you know, and I don't think that as a country we have explored this concept much. We are still very dichotomous about this, you know. It's like English or Maltese, and it's like, first of all, I mean, there is no fully Maltese way of writing things anymore, you know. So if you look at my plays in Maltese, they are sprinkled with phrases in English and sometimes long chunks, because that's the way we speak. So it's not a question of... For me, writing in Maltese is not a question of writing plays where 100% of the words are Maltese words. That's not it for me, you know. I'm writing about my country most of the time, and I'm writing in the language of my country, about the people of my country. So if I have to represent them, because at the end of the day, I mean, theater is a mirror, you know. I mean, that's what it should be. Then I have to mirror back how we're thinking, behaving, and speaking. And if that means code switching, badly constructed sentences, because this is another thing, you know. I mean, theater is not a, it's not a language exercise, you know. I'm not there to show off how good my language skills are, you know. I'm not being a linguist. On the contrary, if I'm writing certain types of characters who would not have perfectly constructed whatever, Maltese, English, whatever the language really. I'm not really doing my job well. But still, I think there is a section of our theatre going audiences that still equate the sense of high, you know, the theatre maybe, I don't know. I mean, this is just my theory, you know, that we, because for a very long time, theatre was something that had stopped being populist. I feel that we went through that in our country. For a while, it was something that, you know, not a lot of people were doing, and we started associating theatre with a certain way of speaking. Then there was a big gap where new Maltese plays were hardly being written. So I think we got stuck a little bit in, you know, trying to remember what plays could have sounded like decades ago, when maybe code switching wasn't as common as it is today, and so on. And then, you know, when things had changed a lot and playwrights started suggesting new ways of speaking. I remember when I wrote Appuntamenti, which was, it was about 14 years ago now. And I think it was one of the first plays to rely heavily on code switching, on people speaking very bad Maltese, very badly constructed Maltese, using swear words. And I remember a lot of, like, not a lot of people, but I mean, I would call them the purists, who were kind of like, but no, why are you peppering the language with English? It was not a done thing at the time. Now nobody really bats an eyelid about it. You see it everywhere. But at the time, and we're talking, you know, 2008, 2009, which is not a really long time ago, and it was something that a lot of people still resisted. A lot of people who were also in the arts world as well. So it wasn't just like random people in the audience. Actually, from experience, I find the average theatre goer who is not actually involved himself in the theatre world, I find that section of the audience usually more open. They're more willing to receive new ideas, new ways of doing things. I mean, I don't want to make sweeping statements, obviously, because everything is very nuanced, but yes, I think it's not a very black and white situation. I mean, we you know, language is a huge, 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 huge pillar of discussion in, you know, when we are talking about who we are, I feel, you know. I mean, 100 years ago, we actually had something we called the language question, and in many ways, I still think we're there. We just changed the languages we are disputing, I think.
That makes sense, mainly because as for people who don't know, like, what Malta is, how much I don't think the word ashamed is the right word for how we kind of view our language. And there's this whole like argument that English is better than Maltese, and I prefer English and it sounds nicer. And I think your work is very much a way of you kind of going, Isma, we live in this country, we use both languages. This is just what the reality is. You don't try and make it perfect or make it worse. You just kind of see what's real and put it on the stage.
Yes, I mean, there's a lot here. And I would really recommend, I don't know, maybe you have already, but I would really recommend speaking to theatre and language historians about this, because I think there's a lot that we need to refer to from a historical and anthropological point of view, to be able to really analyze that question. Because I think the fact that with so many studies having been carried out, and with so many people having made this their area of study, both in terms of language and in terms of arts and theatre and so on, I think that at this point in time, still being so simplistic in explaining the situation as saying, you know, because English is tal pepe and more, you know, there's more value attached to it, and Maltese is the language of the kitchen and people are ashamed of it. I think that's a little bit too simplistic to explain it. And I think enough has been researched and enough has been discovered and enough has been observed to be able to open up that discussion further. I mean, as I said, I think a theatre and a language historian will probably be able to give far more, wider and more more detailed examples and milestones of how we got here. But I think, you know, we have to think in, we have to look at it's a battlefield that has a lot of variables, I feel, because there's thing, I mean, one of them is obviously the post-colonialist sentiment that is still alive and kicking, I feel. There's also this idea that the country is a very young, independent country. So obviously that comes with its transitions. There's also a thing as us bridging to the rest of the world and not being an island anymore. I mean, not in terms of geography, but with the onset of the internet, with joining the EU, suddenly we were not isolated anymore. So we went through a period where we were a little bit drunk on what was happening elsewhere and we wanted to import it. So while we were doing that, there was a period where we kind of forgot about our stories and what we want to say. So that also, you know, there was nothing going on. So the real amazing stuff we were seeing was in English. So suddenly we started thinking, okay, so the good stuff is in English. But because there was very little in Maltese going on. So there's a lot, you know. I honestly don't think it is this one social class thing or intellectual. I think it's more complex than that. And it's a very interesting thing. And I think it's also a very important thing to speak about because I don't think we should be having these conversations in this day and age when, because this is the irony, you know? I mean, we live in this world that is so fast and everyone can be something over nothing in such a short period of time that right now, the only thing the world is obsessed about is specificity, that something is specific about you and only you. Because otherwise you're going to be like everyone else. And yet, I find that in many ways, and I'm not just talking about theatre here, as a country, I think we are still sometimes very obsessed about being like others and not really digging into what makes us specific, good and bad. I mean, I'm not just talking about the nice things about us. I think that's probably part of the problem. We're very scared because if you look in the mirror, you're going to see warts and all, you know?
I just want to take a little bit of that question and then mould it into the next one, because we're going to talk a little bit about how you go about drafting the work. So there's, you know, you've talked a bit about how Malta as a country is innately bilingual.
Yeah.
Is that something that plays a part in how you draft the work? So do you sit there and be like, okay, this piece I want to be in Maltese, this piece I want to be in English. Is it like a character sort of thing, or is it something you explore as you go along the draft? Just kind of give us a little bit of an insight into the Simone drafting experience, shall we call it? Yeah.
I don't think language is a very big, doesn't take up a big chunk of my drafting process, to be honest, because essentially I don't write plays in English anymore. Unless it is commissioned or it's like a very, very, very particular circumstance. I automatically reach out to write a play in Maltese. But as I said, a play in Maltese for me nowadays does not necessarily mean, it never is actually, a play where every single word from beginning to end is in English. But I mean, usually, and I have to make a distinction here between commissioned work and my work, because obviously now this is my job. So sometimes I am commissioned to write work for whatever. I mean, sometimes it's for the theatre and sometimes it's for whatever. I mean, for many different reasons. And commissions sometimes come with instructions or with requirements, or sometimes you're told that you have X amount of actors and sometimes these are the languages. So in that case, the brief affects a lot of decisions in that sense. But when it comes to my work, so the plays which I write which are, you know, more personal because they're about things I personally want to speak about. So nobody has told me, I want you to write about this thing and it's for this event or whatever. Usually there is something very specific I want to say. So something, or something, rather than say, something specific I want to explore, because I don't think it's a question of me saying or dictating anything to anyone. For me, it's more a question of putting my observations in a narrative in a one place. So that is always the first step, you know. If I don't have this sort of fire, this thing that I kind of have to get off my chest, or I have to explore because it's really, you know, eating my brain, I'm not going to start writing. In fact, my plays, in inverted commas, I only write one every 4 years, 5 years, sometimes even longer, you know. I just finished one, coincidentally, which was 4 years after the previous one. So that was a very, very large chunk of time. However, once that is kind of clear in my head, then I usually start exploring sort of what, through which vehicles am I going to tell the story. And usually those vehicles are the characters and the environments and so on. And then based on who these people need to be, I think that's when language comes in. Because it depends on a lot of things, you know. I mean, it depends on the environment I'm choosing to explore. I think it depends on sometimes the time period I'm choosing to explore, the social class I'm choosing to explore. So language is my tool to basically go through the journey. And if that means there are characters that are code switching a lot, if that means that there are characters that are speaking exclusively in English because they're foreign, or maybe they're Maltese people who don't want to speak in Maltese, that's when that choice comes in, but it's never the first choice.
That makes a lot of sense, because like if you're commissioned to do something, or if you have this thing in you that you want to talk about, then it makes sense to kind of start from what you want to say and then mold your process around it, rather than have a kind of process which you stick to everything you do, because obviously every piece is different.
Yes, I mean, commissioned work follows in a very similar manner. I mean, you still, at least I, because I know that other playwrights will do it in a different way, and there's no right or wrong way of doing it, I think. But even if it's a commissioned piece of work, I'm still going to start with sort of the core of what this piece is going to be about. But then usually, as I'm going through the process I just described, then there are certain, steady requirements which I have to factor in, just because whoever commissioned it needs it. And when I say requirements, it's not technically a content requirement. Most of the time, it's a practical logistic requirement, because you know, it sometimes depends on things like budget, you know. For example, I mean, most times it's about budget, because, you know, that's the world we live in. But, I mean, sometimes you can get commissioned to write something, and if the first thing you're told is, listen, this is a small budget production, the production only affords three actors. So you know that, you know, I mean, you're either going to go for a three-hander, or these three people are going to do a lot of characters between them, so automatically that practical requirement is going to shape your choices, your creative choices as well, even though nobody is really interfering with them. Because a lot of people, I think in terms of commission as somebody coming in and bossing you, I want this, I want that, and I want people to say this. It's, I mean, in my experience, it's very, very, very rarely been like that. It's usually these kind of requirements that come in. And to be honest, I don't mind them, because I find them to be very good. I think challenges and boundaries really help you stretch your own skill, you know, because you will have to try and say what you want to say anyway with what you have. And I'm a big proponent for, poor theater, sort of, in a way, because I mean that's how I started. We had absolutely nothing, not a cent to our name, nothing. But that also means you have nothing to hide behind. So it's either going to be good work or, you know, that's it. You're caught in the glare of the light, sort of, you know.
When you're like creating a script and you're starting to do it, do you have like a vision in your head of how you imagine it to be performed? So are you kind of like directing as you're writing, or do you like really know how to cut a line between writing it and kind of directing it? And
now I can do that. When I was younger, it was a little bit harder. For obvious reasons, I think. One is experience, lack of experience. When I was younger, I used to find it harder to write a play and not also direct it while I'm writing it, you know? Which I think is a very, very common thing. I see that a lot in my students, you know, but I think it's very normal. It's a very natural step. On top of that, I actually did have a company in which I was most of the time directing. So my first scripts were kind of written for the company, for the people I knew who are while writing, I would know who was going to be playing what. And I also knew that I would be directing it. So I kind of discovered this in reverse, you know, I think the first 4 years, 5 years of the company, it was always us. So it was always the actors of the company acting. I was always directing it. So I didn't even realize I was doing it. And then it's only when someone objectively looked at it from the outside who kind of said, and I'll never forget this because I think it was one of those ping moments for me. But I have a really good friend of mine. She's a playwright. She's a French playwright. And I was on a residency and she was there as well in France. And she had just read a play I had done here in Malta. And she told me, you know, I really like the play. She said, but she said, this is not a playwright's play. She said, this is director's play. And I just looked at her and I said, like, what does it mean? And she said, well, she said, I could tell that you were writing a lot of things that you were envisaging as a director while you were writing. She said, but if this script had to be in the hands of someone else, you're actually tying that person's hands and forcing them to go for certain choices which were not necessary. And that was quite it was very, a very important moment for me because I became very aware of that. And now, unless I know I will be writing it, but still, even if I know I'm going to be directing it, I try to steer away from that and stick to what is necessary. But nowadays, I'm not a very possessive writer in general. So I have no problems with actors changing words or rewrites if necessary. I'm very open for like feedback and criticism. But if it is a commission where I am just the writer, I very often let it be once I finish the writing and give it over. And I'm like, contact me if you need me, by all means. But I'm not going to butt in and tell you how I think it should be done and all that. And I find it to be quite freeing, actually. It's really, I like it, you know. I like eventually then seeing. I mean, the trick is always to give your script to somebody you trust. That's always the script. That's always the, you know.
What happens if you're commissioned to write a script and the person who's directing it is someone you don't trust?
Well, so far it hasn't happened. Because I've been lucky enough that so far I've always had a say. I'm not territorial or protective of the script once it's being rehearsed, but I will fight tooth and nail for the script to land in the right hands. Because, I mean, I think that's the most important decision. If that decision is made, if it's a good decision, if it's the person you would... Because, I mean, as cliche as the metaphor is, it is like handing your kid to somebody else, you know? It's like you birthed it and they're like, here, go, take care of it. So you obviously want somebody to care for it the way you would have if you were taking care of it. It's a very cliche metaphor, but it's very true. So I think that's the most important decision. Because if that decision is made in a way that you are happy with, then most times what follows from that point onwards is you know, it's going to probably be a good process and something that you like. I haven't experienced that yet. I hope I never do, but I don't know. I try to have as much of a say as I possibly can in that respect. And then I let them be once that decision is made. I don't like to interfere then.
We are going to head to a quick break in a little moment. I have just one little question that I'd like to touch on, which is you talked a little bit about this earlier, that you are now a, in inverted quotations, a full-time artist. So, yeah. Kind of, what was the experience of saying, right, I'm an artist now, this is what I want to do? And how has it kind of been? Like, obviously, pre-corona and during corona are two very different things. But what was the decision-making like for that?
Yeah.
And how has it kind of been for you, would you say?
Well, I mean, I don't think you become... I mean, it's not like I woke up one morning and I was suddenly an artist. I think you are. You are a creative, you know. I don't like to use it very abundantly, the word artist. I think you need to earn it to be called one, you know. I mean, everyone can call themselves an artist, but I think it's your work that should speak for itself and sort of say, I am an artist. And so I still struggle sometimes to say it. In fact, when people ask me, like, what do you do as a job? Usually my answer is, like, I write. That's what I say. And especially with people who are not involved in the theater world, is like, you know, because I think it's like it's a more clear way of explaining what I do, you know. So I was involved in the arts world. I've been involved since I was 16 years old, you know. And while I was slowly learning how to do what I do, and I still am, because I do not think that just because you do it full time, you're suddenly, you know, everything that needs to, you know, that you need to know. You never do. I mean, I think the moment somebody says, I know everything I need to know about what I'm doing, that's the day you have to kind of shut shop. But I was, you know, I was learning how to do, you know, how to write and I was learning on the job, you know, from one production to another, from one piece of writing to another, while also juggling something else, which was completely different. I think the shift came in two ways. From a practical point of view, I felt like I could make that shift because I had, for about like 7-8 years before I became a full, like I did this full time, I started doing this full time. I was already spending like maybe, I don't know, 5 months of the year doing this, because as a teacher, I used to have my summers off. So that's when I kind of lived the full time writer life. So I kind of already knew that. I was already involved in a lot of projects. I used to refuse a lot of projects because I didn't have enough time. So basically what I did was I started accepting more. I took a bit of a risk as well, because when I decided to stop teaching, it's not like, you know, everything was lined up neatly. There was a jump in the dark that I kind of had to take. But I decided to do it. I was 36 years old when I did this, by the way. So it was I said, listen, you know, if I don't do it now, I'll never do it. And I will seriously regret it if I don't. So I kind of just said, you know, I'm just going to jump and see what happens. I took a year off from teaching and said, maybe if it doesn't work out, maybe I can go back. Within a month of doing it full time, I was like, okay, I'm not going back. and then obviously COVID hit. So I was like, maybe I will have to go back. But then I said, no, I said, I want to risk it. I'd rather risk it and fail than, you know, choosing the safe way. So that was one of that was a practical reason. The other reason was that I just couldn't keep doing what I was doing. I was at a point in my life where I was like, I have to be fully authentic to who I am. I felt like I was, it was almost like living a double life, you know, completely out in the open, not in the sense of living a double life, one of them being in secret. I was openly a teacher, and I learned a lot, and I think I'm the writer I am today because of the 15 years I spent as an educator, because you get to see humanity as a teacher. That's what you get to see. And I loved my students, and I miss, you know, that contact with young people that I had at the time. However, I felt like, you know, there was this part of me that it's like I had two feet in two different universes, and it was very clear which one of them made me happiest. So I said, you know, I can't keep doing this way. I was always also very disappointed in the education system, the way things were going. I was not very happy with how things were, and I was not happy with how things looked like they were gonna become. So, you know, and I didn't want to, and as I said, I wanted to be authentic to myself, and I felt like I was essentially existing in something that I was no longer believing in. So, you know, I said, it is literally now or never. I'm just gonna go for it. This is something that is very clear is what I should be doing. Yes, it's risky. Yes, I don't know if this is gonna work out at any given point. I mean, I am very, very grateful that I have not stopped for a second since then. But I mean, you know, the art world is very fickle. So I'm always aware of the fact that we don't know what's gonna happen. We had a pandemic, you know, there's a World War III might start next week. We don't know, you know. But I just kind of said, listen, I want to look back and say I did what I wanted to do at the best of my ability. If I fail, I fail, you know, so what? So many people have failed before me. I'm not going to be the first or the last one to fail. So we'll see. So far, so good.
We are going to take a quick break. We have Simone Spiteri. We are going to be right back. And we're back. We are going to delve a little bit more into the wonderful, wonderful world of Miss Simone Spiteri. We'll talk a little bit about your company Do now, if I assume I've pronounced that correctly.
Perfect.
So I was reading an article about the company, and it would have been published in, let's say, 2019, and it was because you were doing a revival of Appuntamenti.
Yeah.
Which, for anybody listening who is English, translates to appointments. And that's a piece that, you know, it explores relationships and chance encounters.
Yeah.
So I would like to ask, when the piece originally performed, so that's 2009, and when the piece came back for round two in 2019,
yeah,
would you say it held the test of time?
I think it did. And I think I can sort of reach that conclusion because of two things. One, because we hardly touched the script. We didn't change anything, essentially. The only thing that we did tweak a bit was that in 2009, we weren't social media dependent. And I mean, the play is not very... It doesn't really rely much on social media. So, you know, in 2009, we were still using the standard mobile phones, whereas we just referred to them as smartphones in the 2019 version. But that was pretty much it. We didn't really change anything else. So the fact that we, you know, the text kind of stayed in its original state, and leading me to the second thing, which was it was received very well. I think it did stand the test of time. I mean that's what I was kind of hoping for, and it was the risk sort of that we took as a company. However, we didn't just revive it because we wanted to see if it stood the test of time. I mean, there were many reasons why we did. First of all, it was a 10-year anniversary from when it was performed and from when it won the Francis de Bayer Prize. And also, I think, and it was also published. And it was published in a double bill, which was, one was Appuntamenti, and the other one was a play which we also premiered in 2019, which was Repubblica Immacolata. And the reason why we chose those two plays to publish, I mean, the first thing that I have to say is that for a play to be published in Malta, that is akin to a miracle, you know? It is just not done. And it's not done because publishers will, very rightly so, because from a financial point of view, I completely understand it. It is not financially viable, you know, for the expenses that the publisher has to incur to publish a play text, vis-a-vis the amount of times that play text is going to be bought. It just makes no financial sense for publishers. So obviously, you hardly ever see published plays, which we, people who are in the people who are teaching or just practitioners in the theater world locally, that's also one of the reasons why we have so little access to plays in Maltese, because the majority of them get lost once the performance is over because they're not published. So unless you know somebody from the original production, or you know some, you know the playwright himself or herself, and you get in touch and you ask for a copy, that's it. There's no access to it. So I was lucky enough to get the fund, the Book Council fund for to publish it. And the reason why we published those two is because I wanted to put them sort of in the same publication. One, because one of them was 10 years old, and because I think they were sort of two important points in the history of the company, in my journey as a writer. And I think both contributed in a way to shake things up a little bit in the local theatre scene, I think. I mean, it's not really my place to kind of really analyze that, you know. I just wrote that, so I think other people should be analyzing how much it changed or not. But the reasons why I think those three things were important, from a company point of view, I think Appuntamenti was the first time that we had a more diverse cast, because we were working with people who were outside of the core company. As I said earlier, I think we were pushing boundaries even in terms of style and the way people spoke. Personally, I think from a writing point of view, I think that's when I kind of started coming a little bit into my own as a writer. I had written many, many, many plays before that, but they were more fringe plays. I remember the first few years of our theatre group, I would never put my name down as the playwright, because I felt like, you know, who the hell am I and why should I be, you know, I felt like I needed to earn the right to call myself a playwright. So it took me a long time to kind of let my team put my name down on the poster or the program or whatever. I was young, I was like 22, 23. And it, like, even in terms of local theatre, as I said, you know, it kind of presented characters that were more, they were closer to the people watching it, you know? A lot of people were watching it and they could say, yes, I can see my friend in this character. Yes, this is how I speak. Yes, this is how I spend my normal day in 2009 Malta at the time. With Repubblica, it was my most political play up to that point. Not anymore. I think there's one that is more political coming up. but up to that point, it was my most political play. And I think through a series of things, I think it was a timely play. I mean, this was just before the country went into meltdown with political shakeups and a lot of things that we got to know about what was happening before resignations, before a very turbulent year, and before the mass protests in streets. So it was sort of a moment where the bubble was about to start getting a little bit too close to bursting point. And I think it pricked people in an uncomfortable way. It didn't make people feel very comfortable. And I think why the reason why it struck so much with so many people, because I believe that every theater should be a mirror, whatever that theater is. It doesn't always have to be serious or political or whatever. But I think we were at a point in time, and this was the beginning of 2019. Now we're not talking about a decade ago, but I believe we're in a different world now. But I think at the time we were a little bit under some kind of anesthetic, I think. So suddenly people were like squirming in their seats because they were sort of trapped in a theater seat and they were being told, hang on, you know, we're not as friendly, funny, sunny, welcoming and pretty and naive as we want to present ourselves. And I think it created a lot of discomfort. It also created a lot of relief. In a really weird way, because I think people saw a lot of their inner thoughts being said aloud in an entertaining way, because the play was still quite entertaining, you know, the production itself and the performances were amazing, and I mean hats off to all the actors, because it was thanks to them that people could really connect. And people could connect to whatever level they were ready to connect with. I mean, some people came to watch it and they just wanted to connect to the human side and the human element of the play, while others were just more in tune with the political side of things. So, you know, I felt that those two plays were important to be put in the same publication for different reasons. Also because they were sort of the two ends of a stick in the Do Theater history stroke my journey as a writer, I think. So there were many reasons why that happened. And also it was we started the year with Republica and ended it with Appuntamenti. And Appuntamenti was a bit of an antithesis of Republica, because it was a very small and minimalist and simple and intimate performance, whereas Republica was more epic and it was like a big scale production. So and that, you know, I mean, that's the last time we had a production as Do. But, I mean, there was a time when we were younger and freer and kidless, childless, because, I mean, the core company, there's like 7 kids between them. I don't have kids, but some of the other members, they and we're all women, so they're mothers, and motherhood has obviously taken a lot of their time. And so nowadays we group together and we get together and do something every couple of years. And thankfully, it was just before COVID. So we wrapped up everything and kind of said, okay, guys, see you in 3 years. Little did we know that, you know, COVID was just around the corner.
So cute. It's like you guys knew you knew that the world needed a break, that the world is going to go on a break.
Well, no, we did not know at all. But things kind of worked out well for us. Let's just say that, because, I mean, the amount of friends and colleagues and some other commissioned projects I was involved in that went through 10 versions and postponement and rethinking and rewriting because of COVID. So, I mean, Do was lucky in that sense.
We've mentioned Do as a company a lot, but we haven't like really touched on how it all started. Like, what's the origin story of Do?
It's a very funny one. And a very crazy one, I think, and random. So basically, just a bit of context. So when I was a teenager, anyone who wanted to be involved in the arts and wanted to get some form of training, there was only one place that you could go to, which was the drama center, which was the government-run drama school. And I feel like I was super lucky, because I think I was there during a peak moment when Josette Chapara was the head, and we were there for the full time, not the full time course, but it used to be called the senior course, which was basically the most intensive one. And it was really a magical time, because it was a 3-year program, and you got to work with all the best teachers on the island. And Josette also, she was quite avant-garde in that respect, because she understood the importance of reaching beyond our boundaries, even our geographical boundaries. This is pre-EU. So like the possibility to be involved in things outside of the country were more difficult. But she really pushed us to travel. We used to travel all the time to festivals and perform in them, and to drama exchanges. And she used to bring over a lot of people to give masterclasses. So, and really big people. So like at the age of 18, 19, I had workshops with people from DV8 and Cheek by Jowl. And, you know, I mean, and I was like really, really, really young and told by an idiot. And like some really amazing people, which for an 18-year-old, it was like, you know, it was like somebody took me to a sweet shop, and I just went insane. So basically, and at the same time, I was reading my degree at university, which was more theory based at the time, but they kind of complemented each other well. So in the morning we used to have lectures, and in the evening we would be in the practical world of theater, sort of. So by the time we finished both the university degree and the program at the drama center, they finished at the same time, and I was not even 21 years old at the time. You would have had roughly 10, 12 productions in 3 years, and we were like traveling and masterclasses all the time. And then suddenly everything is over, and you just have to sit at home and just wait for somebody to call you who would have maybe seen you in the showcase and say, oh, I have this tiny little part, do you want to do it? And if you're lucky, you get it, you know. And there wasn't as much going on as there was today either. So, you know, and I just was not going to have it. And I said, no way, you know, I'm not going to go after all this intensity and, you know, building this momentum. And I'm just not going to stop and stay at home and wait. And I remember there used to be this summer festival, which was like a 30-minute play festival. And it used to be at Spazio Creative. And anyone could submit a play. And I remember in June of my third year, so I was doing my university finals, and I was also doing rehearsing for the showcase at the... Because that's how it ended. We had like this big showcase. We ended with the showcase at the drama center, and I don't know how I managed, but I wrote a 30-minute play in all of this madness, and I submitted it, and I said, anyways, you know, nobody's going to read it, probably. And I still remember where I was, and I remember Josette, who was the artistic director, calling me, and she's like, yes, you're in. And I said, what do you mean? She's like, yes, it's one of the plays chosen. And I said, okay. And she goes, okay, who's the cast? And I obviously had nothing, like I had not planned anything, I had nothing. And I said, and it was a two-hander, it was a guy and a girl. And I said, me? And she said, who's directing it? Me? Okay, so are you playing the girl? Yes. Who's playing the guy? And I just kind of stopped, because we used to be a group of like 16 girls and two guys, you know? And one of the guys was already... involved in another play, and the other guy was a medicine student, so he was like, no, I'm busy. So I had no guy to play opposite. And then I said, maybe the guy can become a girl, maybe, you know. And I said, okay, it's not really gonna make much of a difference. Instead of them being a couple, they're gonna be sisters. So I take my phone and I'm like, hi, Magda was also doing the program and the degree, and I was like, Magda, there's a play and you are in it. Bye. And Magda's really chill and cool. And she was like, oh, okay. Yeah, all right. So I called Josette back and I'm like, okay, Josette, I have a team. And she's like, all right, I'm at the printers. I'm going to start printing the program. What's the company's name? And I said, what do you mean? She said, what's the company's name? Do you have a company? And I said, no. She said, you need a company. And I said, okay, me and Magda, we're a company. And she's like, what's the name? And I said, I don't have a name. Make one up now. And I said, do. And she goes like, okay, bye. And just like hangs up. And then I go to Magda and I'm like, Magda, we have a group name, apparently. And she says, and what does it mean? And I said, well, you know, so we kind of worked it in reverse. I'm like, yeah, do sounds like the verb to do, but maybe, you know, we're Maltese, so let's write it phonetically. And, you know, this thing exists because we want to do stuff, not stay at home. And anyway, and we did this first production, and she said, yeah, we'll change it later, you know, let's just go with it. And then, eventually, we'll just change it. But then, like, 2 or 3 years down the line, everyone knew us as the Doogers. And I was like, listen, guys, we're not really going to change it now. So we didn't. And 18 years later, it's still Doom, and we're still the same people.
Oh, that's hilarious. I like how it's very much like a, all right, this happened. Oh, there's meaning. Oh, this means that.
No,
and
no, no.
That.
Yeah.
That's so theatre, making meaning out of something that was there in the first place.
I mean, in our defence.
it is actually what we are about, because I'm like, you know, let's just shut up and do it. You know, I'm that kind of person. And especially when it comes to theatre, I'm like, you know, it's meant to be done. It's not meant to be read. It's not meant to be... philosopher. I mean, yes, it's all part of it, but ultimately theater exists because it is done, you know. You need something done for theater to exist. So, you know, I'm quite happy with my stroke of random group name inventing on the spot.
There's one particular piece of Doos that caught my eye, like, this is me specifically when I was looking at it, and that was Fly Flim.
Yeah.
And to our listeners, it was a piece of shadow puppetry performance in 2014, and that was commissioned by the Children's Festival Ziggy Zag.
Yeah, I think it was 14, 15, I'm not sure, yeah. Round about that time.
Now, the reason it caught my attention is because, as someone who's worked with puppetry in the past, it, at least this is me personally, it is quite hard to make a show about puppetry writing something beforehand. Like, for me, it was a case of, okay, we're going to make it up into space and see what sticks. Or devise is a better word.
Yeah.
So I want to talk about that process. Was it something you devised? And was it like a bit of a departure from, okay, we're going to write something? Yeah.
Well, I think there is something else that I have to describe before getting into the puppet making and how the rehearsal process unfolded. The whole idea originated from something completely different, which was we had already, both as Du, but even myself as a freelance writer, we and I had been part of Zigguzaik quite a number of times, and it was picking up steam, and everyone was kind of seeing this huge gap that this festival had suddenly filled. And it was not just an important gap that was filled for the kids and young adults, who, as I said before, I never had anything to go see and watch as a kid, you know, there was none of that. But it was also it also opened a world of experimentation and finding new skills for the artists themselves, you know. I mean, I think all the best artists of the island have at some point worked for Zigguzaik. So it's been amazing for everyone, audience and artists. But having every year been somehow involved, either sometimes as a writer or whatever, or a director or whatever, and seeing all these kids, hundreds of kids filing in and having the time of their life and exploring this world that, you know, is magical, and it's magical for adults and young people alike. I suddenly had this idea, and I said, you know, what about the kids who have no access to this, but for health reasons, you know, there are so many kids in hospital who are probably the ones who need the entertainment the most. But there is no way for them to come to Valletta, because that's where Zigguzaik is usually based, and experience this along with, you know, their peers are doing. So we kind of started from there, and we wanted to take the theatre to these kids as opposed to bringing them to us, because obviously they couldn't. So that was kind of the first step. And the idea of a puppet theatre came as a result of, as I said before, I mean, requirements sometimes push you into a specific creative direction, because we kind of said, okay, what are we working with here? So we knew that we were going to be allowed into the hospital wards, we knew that we were going to be allowed into wards where you had kids who were staying there overnight. So I don't know, like a kid broke a leg or something, you know, like they're there for a night with the parents or whatever. But we in the wards, so with places where you have more than one bed. But we also knew that we were going to be allowed into the ward where you had the kids who were there long term, and they were connected to tubes and pipes and machinery, and some of them were terminally ill, and some of them could barely raise their head off the pillow, and they had a private room, and the family was kind of living there. It was like an extended family environment. So we knew that, listen, in most cases, we're going to be not just going to the hospital, but going to the bedside, literally. The kid is not going to be able to get out of bed. So when we started sort of brainstorming, so what kind of theater can literally get on a bed? And we sort of said, listen, we need something that can literally be wheeled from one place to another quickly. We need something which is short, so a show that can be repeated 7, 8, 10 times in a morning or in an evening. And most importantly, it needs to be something that is visual. So we decided on shadow puppetry, because we created this screen theater that was wheeled and that would literally wheel itself up to the bed. So the bed was just touching the edge of the screen, okay? And we were a team of four. So kind of from a practical point of view, we kind of knew that, listen, this is what we're going to be working with. And then when it came to the piece itself, I wanted to sort of write something that echoed a little bit the experience of what the kids were going through, but at the same time, keep the magic and keep the colors and keep the fun and keep the funny side. Because, you know, I mean, we kind of just wanted to make them smile. It's not a place that makes you smile, you know. And so basically kind of I wrote this little story about this flamingo who is on a journey with his flock, and he falls and is injured and has to find his way home through this injury. And on the way, he meets a lot of animals which he would have otherwise not met if he just flew along with everyone else, until he basically finds the flock. And what I did was, I didn't really write a script in the way I would write like a straightforward play. I kind of wrote a short story. And from the short story then, so we had that as a base. Like, you know, it's like, these are the characters, this is the general narrative of what we wanna do. And then that's when the experimentation started, because we had stick puppets. So the puppets were puppets that sort of move at the joints. And the joints had these like little Chinese style sticks, because we needed to be standing at the side of this little stage screen that we had and be able to maneuver it. And we just had a really basic light. But that's when the devising came in, because obviously you imagine something and then you try it, and the neck of the flamingo doesn't want to stay straight, and the tortoise is, you know, that's where you try things out. And how you make a change from one to the other, what kind of gimmick can you use to make them look like they're flying, or like, you know, I don't know, the flamingo at one point needs to climb on top of the shell, or the tortoise shell, and then we had monkeys, so how do you create, or things like, how do you create the fall of a bird, you know, how do we get this idea that it's falling through these really, really long trees. So that is something that we created a lot of puppets, we threw away a lot of puppets, because they wouldn't be working, and then we did it. To me, I mean, it was a very hard process, because obviously there's a lot of construction that needs to be done, and as I said, not everything works, and so on, but that paled in comparison to the experience of being there, you know. I mean, we went in wanting to make these kids smile, which we did, but I don't think we cried as hard as we, I mean, it was a very intense experience. I mean, not with the kids, because we were kind of coached a bit in how we sort of present ourselves, and we were just, you know, there, and we were providing fun. And but, you know, I mean, once we packed up and left the hospital, we just were wrecks. I mean, it was a very, very, very difficult, challenging thing to do. It was also very, very interesting, because it shows you realities which, thankfully, a lot of people don't ever get to see in a lifetime. But it also shows you things. Like, for example, one of the things that stuck with me, and this is quite a long time ago that we did this, but, like, for example, especially with the very, very sick kids, most of the time the families would be living there with the kid, especially if they would be there for a treatment for a couple of weeks. And if there was a sibling or siblings, they too would be staying there. So in a way, it was like the sibling who was not having health complications, they were still living a hospital life. So you know, I had never thought of that. And I felt... And hadn't crossed my mind, but it is such a basic thing to think of, you know? And suddenly it became about families, about the patient, but about the families as well, because the adults were invested in this flamingo as much as the kid was, because, and at one point, like, the doctors were telling each other from one ward to another, and before you know it, there were, like, seven doctors watching the flamingo, you know? So it was a special, challenging experience. I can't say we are expert puppeteers. I don't think we will ever be. But I think that project was a little bit beyond the quality of the work itself. I think the reason why we were doing it was more important, I think.
And I was going to say that, in fact, if you didn't, like, when it comes to, because I have been in the hospital when I was younger, and I know what it feels like to kind of be there, bored out of your damn mind, you can't get up out of bed, and you're just like, what do I do? So kind of even having you guys going there and doing something different felt like they got to go out on a day, on a field trip to somewhere, and I'm definitely 100% sure that they all loved it, even if you put on a show that theatrically would have been horrible, they still would have loved every second of it.
And theatre should have no borders, you know? And I think, even from that point of view, the fact that we were taking theatre to them, I think that's also important, because, yes, it's nice to get the opportunity to go inside the theatre. There's nothing more magical than that. But that's not the only way theatre can be done.
In times where they can't kind of go out and meet the world, it's nice to have the world meet
come them. To you. Yes, exactly, that was the whole point.
Okay, I'm gonna wrap up this little sad section.
Yes.
And ask you a bit of an open, kind of a big question.
Okay.
What do you feel a contemporary Malta is in terms of, like, the arts, and in terms of not where we're heading, but kind of
what it is right now?
How would you define it rather than what it is right now? So for you, if you were to kind of, if someone was to ask you to define contemporary Malta, how would you kind of define it, for lack of a better word?
But based on what I'm observing, you mean present, like what is happening, not what I think should happen or what will happen or what it needs to be, like what is right now?
I would say so.
Yeah.
And yeah, from I'd
a,
say so.
Yeah, from a theatre point of view?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Hmm. Well, I mean, for sure it is the scene in general, it's kind of waking up after, you know, after COVID. So the fact that the past month has been so full of things happening, I think that it's that alone is already a relief. Now, what it is, theatrically speaking, well, I think there is a bit of an effort, perhaps, for boundaries I would like to say pushed, but I think that's too strong a verb for what we're doing. I think that there's an envelope, you know, staring us in the face. There are, you know, it's there. Whereas I think there was a long, long period of time where we weren't even looking at it. In some cases, we're in denial about it. Now I think it's there. I think some people are kind of trying to tickle it into some sort of movement. Very gingerly, I think. But, you know, I mean, if you look at the kind of work that has been created in the last few months, I would say, because, you know, with COVID, things were put, they were at a bit of a standstill. I think there has been an attempt in some cases for, you know, to start exploring things that should be explored. Is it enough? No. Not by a long stretch. I think we have to... Not have to, but I think that there are so many things that have happened, are happening, will keep happening. And I think it's time to stick our heads out of the sand. I don't think we have any excuses anymore, to be honest. Nationally and globally, you know, the metaphoric knocking on the door is now a loud bang, and the door is gonna like break in two very soon, I think. And the fact that we are not grabbing the bull by the horns as much as we should, I don't know. It's not something that I think we should be doing more in that respect. However, I at the same time, not to sound too negative, I think there is quite a refreshing effort for people to try new things, to explore things in a different way, which I think is very important. My biggest, the biggest sadness I have about theatre at the moment in Malta is that we have pretty much close to killed off the fringe, the concept of fringe, which I think is central to any theatre community. Not just because traditionally the fringe is where voices get very loud and experimentation can be pushed. It's not just that. But I also believe that the fringe is where the best mistakes can be made. And I think we are living in such a, not a community, we're living in a society that is so unforgiving of people who make mistakes, especially with the young people, that everyone is just terrified of making a mistake. And the only way that you can learn and grow as an artist, as a human, as whatever, is by making mistakes. And you only make mistakes if you go through all the steps. Because the other thing is, life is so fast and everything is so instantaneous that a lot of people have forgotten that things can't happen overnight. The world is trying to kid us into thinking that things happen overnight, but they don't. They do not. None of the things that happen overnight, even if they look like they have, they don't. Okay? And a lot of people are trying to skip the steps because they think that that's the way things should be done. The patience to go through the steps and falling 500 times while you're doing that and picking yourself up every single time with more knowledge in your bag than the previous time, a lot of people are skipping that important step, I feel. So what is, and because the fringe is almost non-existent, the possibility to have a safe but open sandbox is not there. And because it is not there, when people are actually involved in something, the stakes are way too high straight away. So coupled with this idea of, I have to be perfect, I cannot make a mistake, plus the stakes are so high and weighing you down, then it just becomes a cocktail for, I don't know, I don't know what to call it, petrified action, you know? The amount of time that I see this in young people and people are asking me, is this how I should be doing it? One, there is no right or wrong, I think. Nobody should be looking for approval from anything, because theatre, art, it's an extension of who you are. Nobody should tell you who you are or what you want to say. So asking somebody to tell you if this is good or not. People can mentor you and people can give you a lot of feedback, but not permission, you know, which and feedback and mentorship is not the same as permission, I think. So that's the first thing. And, you know, the other thing is that we are, it's really ironic that because it is so complex and so contradictory at the same time that things are very fast, but at the same time, we're very cautious. We want to do things overnight, but then we do not have the possibility to let things cook because that's when things are you know, they that's where flavor comes from, you know? So I just think that as a society, not as theater, as a society, I think we're a very confused society. And as everything, what a society is what filters into everything else, because everything else is a mirror, is mirroring back to that society. So I think we're a little bit confused overall, and sometimes that confusion is felt even in the artistic world, I feel. And mind you, this is not just a local thing. I always say it, Malta is a microcosm, it's a micro of the macro. The only thing that sets us apart here is that, you know, the ripple effect for us is a tsunami. That's the only difference, because what happens here happens elsewhere. But, you know, it's so small and everyone is elbowing each other because of literal lack of space, not just physical space. So we kind of feel it a bit faster and a little bit more strongly, but that's pretty much it. So I don't know. I mean, I don't know how COVID and an imminent world war is going to do to us. I mean, COVID has not really made me very hopeful because it has really shown we don't learn and we just keep repeating the same thing. Maybe it's just part of the human experience. I don't know. I'm just very interested in this, you know, the cyclical way of how humans behave. And it's like we have this innate need to implode every now and then because we just, I don't think we can take the pressure. At some point, we need to let it out somewhere. And it's usually in an aggressive way. I don't know. I don't know if I've answered your question.
For quite a loaded question, I think you've navigated it very well. Like it's these sorts of questions that really interest me. Just because, you know, we've had a whole host of companies and practitioners from Malta come on here. And as someone who is, in case it isn't obvious already, not from Malta, it just fascinates me to kind of hear all this sort of like bubbling energy, if that makes sense. It feels like there's such a just like a burning passion, I think, that is, I wouldn't say not around in the UK, but definitely not to the extent, yeah, I would wager. But we'll put that one to bed for now because we'll be here all night.
Yeah.
So I will. I just want to ask you one more personally, which is, what piece of practical advice would you give to somebody who's interested in writing and producing their first piece? Now, by practical, I mean beyond your just do it and your have funds. I mean your okay, what's this thing that I keep cropping up, that keeps cropping up every time that I do it, that is something that I really, really wish I knew more about from day one?
Well, when it comes to writing, the most obvious, but it's what I find myself repeating to my students over and over again, is sit down and write it. It's the most obvious thing I can say. But I can tell you from experience and from working with a lot of people who are in writing programs and so on, that is usually the biggest hurdle. A lot of people have a lot of ideas and they talk about them and they want to do this one day, but yes, but this, and you know, it's just like, okay, now sit, you know, it's what I said, shut up and write it, you know? It might be crap, so try it, you know? And then you can revisit it maybe, or maybe you will throw it away, or maybe it will be a masterpiece on the first try. Just sit down and write it, because at the end of the day, a script, like a story in your head, is a story in your head, full stop. That's it, okay? The second thing is obviously getting it done, and I will get into that, because again, writing something that you're going to keep on a shelf is something on a shelf, you know? I mean, it needs to go, I mean, with theater, there are many, many phases, and those phases involve a lot of people, and sometimes most of those phases do not involve you. So once you do write it, the first thing that I would suggest is get people to read it. And when I say get people to read it, not just the people who might help you actually get it made, but get people to read it just so you can look at yourself through other people's eyes, yourself in terms of the writing. And when I say get people to read it, don't just go to the inverted commas experts, because I feel, and I see this from, a lot of my students. When I say, guys, get somebody to read this, automatically everyone wants to get in touch with my friend, the director, that director I admire, that writer I admire, which is fine. I mean, if you do have the contact, go for it. But why not ask your friend who has never been inside the theater? Why not ask a family member? Why not ask somebody that you know? Because at the end of the day, good work resonates with everyone, not just the people who have the know-how. I mean, yes, you have to convince those people to do your work. But at the end of the day, your work needs to be strong enough to resonate with everyone. And do not discount the kind of feedback people that don't have the know-how will give you. Personally, I love when my friends who are not involved in the theater give me feedback, because they don't have the vocabulary to beat about the bush. They like it, they don't like it. This is the same thing when I work for young people. They are the best and scariest audience. Because if they hate it, they will tell you. And they will tell you why, and they will tell you how, and they will tell you how old you are, and they will tell you how uncool you are. But that's what you need to hear if you want to make this resonate with a young person. I'm 38 years old. What do I know about being 16? You know, I'm not 16, and the world was definitely not what the world is for a 16-year-old today when I was 16. So if I want a 16-year-old to sit in a seat and nod their head and say, yes, this could be my story, I better get some 16-year-olds on board for them to read what I'm writing. Okay? So that is the second part, which I feel a lot of people just plain skip. Oh, yes, I wrote it. Let's get into theater. Let's start rehearsing. No, it doesn't work like that. Now, when it actually gets to the actual putting up of a piece, it depends a little bit on a lot of things. If you are already, from experience, a lot of people who want to write are usually already somehow involved in the theater world. The majority of writers start out as actors, or maybe they were actors and tried to direct. So chances are that people might already somehow know people in the theater world. So it takes one person that you trust. You get that person to read it and collaborate. Sometimes, and this is not necessary, but sometimes you can go down the road of like, listen, there is no one who is willing to do it. So let me put a team together to do it. If you can, why not? If you are completely, completely disengaged from this world, but you want to try and write, well, I would suggest that while you are exploring and writing, start placing yourself in environments where you can meet like-minded people. Sign up for masterclasses, get yourself into programs. If there is an open reading, sign up for it, you know, get to know people, because this is a collective endeavor. Theater is not a solo, it's not a solo thing. So you need to connect with people and have patience. You know, I think the two things I would say to a writer is watch as much theater as you can, read as many plays as you can, you know, And plays and theater, Netflix is not a reference for playwriting, you know? I am tired of seeing plays, which are technically screenplays, not stage plays. They are two complete, I mean, it's not one is better than the other. It's just like, you know, judo and football. Two amazing sports, but two different sports, you know? I can't take judo in the middle of a football pitch and expect the footballer to score. I mean, it makes no sense. So playwrights need to feed themselves, and you feed yourself by reading plays, because you get to see what structure looks like, what voices look like, what formatting looks like, and most importantly, watch plays, good and bad. You don't have to watch masterpieces all the time. Watching bad theater sometimes is important because you learn what you should not do, what you would not do. And that is extremely important, I think. And make mistakes. Have patience. You have to have patience because you will not get it right. You will never get it fully right. You will always look back at something you wrote and you're like, ugh, you know, what was I thinking? I mean, that doesn't ever, it's never going to go. But you just have to be able to take what you learned from something and then try something else. But it is a process. It's not called a process for nothing because it's long. It can be tedious. Sometimes it can be boring because sometimes you just have to go through books of boring data just to write four lines in a scene. And a lot of people are not willing to put in that work because I always say this, theater is an iceberg. We just get to see the tip, and the tip looks amazing because you go and it's in the theater and the lights and the costumes and the excitement and, you know, but nobody tells you about what's underneath the water. And it's large and it's heavy and it can be, it's hard work, and it takes time, it takes years, you know, it takes years for, because at the end of the day, what are you doing as a writer? You are analyzing the experience of being human. Now, you as a human take time to form, to grow, to learn, so why should your writing not be the same? Anyone's writing, so yes, I think, and just keep trying, as in, there's no certainty in any of this.
Mm-hmm. I think the second you look back on a work and you don't see something you don't like about it, then that means you're stuck. You need to stop and kind of like, okay, what's wrong? How can it be that from writing this, for example, a year ago, now I don't see what I could have done better?
No, I actually think it's the other way around. I think if you look back and don't like something and something you wrote and you liked it when you wrote it, that means you've grown.
That's what I mean. As in, I mean that you liked it during the time and
now you don't. So that means you've shifted. There's been some kind of shift. And even if you do like it, it's not a question of hating something all the time. I mean, we mentioned Appuntamenti. I like Appuntamenti, but I was 23 years old when I wrote it. Now, as a 38-year-old, I look back and I'm like, you know, how innocent I was in certain ways. It's not a question of hating, but I hope I don't write like that anymore. You know, it would be a huge problem if I was still writing like that. It's not a question of good or bad, or it's just different because you grow as a human being. I mean, I think it's one of the jobs where how you develop as a human is going to have a direct effect on your work. Emotionally, if you're emotionally immature, it's going to be very difficult to understand characters because you have to be very sharp to understand why people are behaving the way they're behaving and speaking the way they're speaking and treating each other the way that they are. So I think that's what you have. That's the sign of growth, that you can look back and say, love it or hate it, I'm now in a different space because I've moved forward. You know, I've made a different step, and maybe I might do things differently. But yes, it's not an easy exercise to do. I think to look back on your own work. In fact, I think most people, like, I don't really particularly enjoy rereading my work, for example. But sometimes you have to, and sometimes you have to force yourself just to kind of, you will cringe, like there's no tomorrow most of the time, but. But I think it's necessary, because otherwise, how are you going to know where you're at? Yeah.
We have One last question for you, Tim.
Far away.
Enjoy your Tuesday evening. What's the next stage for you? Do you have any upcoming projects? How are you like? Is there something you want to tell us about? I don't know.
Yes. Yes, there is a lot. Well, I mean, there's a lot of stuff that I am working on in terms of like, I mean, writing. I have some commissioned projects which I am working on, and I should be filming Castillo over the summer, which is going to be a feature film. But I'm not writing there at all. I think the biggest project, which has already taken up a year of my time and is going to take at least another year now, which is the Pipelines project. It's a play which I just finished. It's called, I haven't told anyone what it's called, so you're going to hear it first. like only my team know. Anyway, it's a play, it's called Lupo Naja, which for you, Toby, it means wolf/sheep. basically this is a play which was commissioned by the European Theatre Convention and along with another four European playwrights. We're all writing a play each about a common theme, but obviously from the point of view of our culture and country and so on, and then this play is going to be translated, and this coming June it will be presented in Austria in English, but it's going to premiere in Malta, in Maltese, probably in about a year's time, produced in collaboration with, it's a Do Theatre production in collaboration with Teatro Malta, which I will be directing. Yeah, that's going to take quite a chunk of my time, and it's a very important play for me. As I said at the beginning, just to come full circle, it was no fun writing it, but because of what it is about, not because I mean I'm gonna, now that the draft is ready, the fun part starts. But yeah, I think it was like The Exorcist on another level that I've never experienced before. Just to go back where we started from.
Was this the piece that you had sticky notes all over?
I still have them. I can show you. They're there. See?
Yep. There they are.
I kept them there because I'm still doing edits to the piece. So I'm just like scared of forgetting a detail. So before I'm like really done, I'm not going to take them out of there because it took me forever to create that, which I never do, by the way, but this play needed it.
Listen, Sim, Tob, this has been amazing. Thank you very much for coming on, Simon. Thank you very much for like accepting our invitation and just talking and being yourself and just answering as truthfully as you could everything we've asked and thrown your way.
Thank you. I really loved it. As I told you before we started recording, I'm a podcast junkie. This is my first podcast and I was really excited about it. So thank you for inviting me.
Thank you so much, guys. We will see you in like 2 weeks' time. And as always, this has been The Next Stage. Bye, everyone.
Bye.